Good morning.
Good morning.
Hope everyone had a great weekend. So today we are going to discuss the LSZ, or layman semantic Zimmermann reduction formula. And this is part of a longer calculation we're going to do this week. So I want to outline where we're going for the whole week, and then I'll tell you how this formula fits into that picture. So our goal is to compute a scattering amplitude, which we can write in two ways. The Heisenberg picture, it's the amplitude for some initial state to evolve in time to some final state. So here, S is a time evolution operator. We can also write this in the Schrodinger picture, where the amplitude we're trying to compute is the amplitude for some initial state at time equals minus infinity to evolve into some final state at future infinity. And the initial and final states we'll be interested in will be momentum eigenstates. So we'll assume that our initial state, for simplicity, has two particles with definite three momentum and therefore a definite energy, so it's a definite energy momentum. And for simplicity, we'll assume it has two particles. And the final state might have two particles or might have some other number of particles. So these are the amplitudes we'll be interested in. Our initial states, the most interesting case for us will be two particles, but sometimes we'll be interested in decay, where we start with one particle. And our final state will generally have a small number of particles, two or three, maybe four. So this is the amplitude we're trying to compute. And we're going to do this in steps. So our goal is to compute FSI, scattering amplitude. And what we're going to see today is that we can write this amplitude, which is written in terms of momentum eigenstates, which we can write in terms of ladder operators acting on the vacuum. We can also write this in terms of an amplitude that involves fields. So fields are the way we formulate our theory. So it'll be easier in practice if we can compute this amplitude using fields instead of directly using the ladder operators. That's going to be the main result for today. We will derive a formula that relates the amplitude we're trying to compute to a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields. This is what the LSZ reduction formula will give us. And to recall, what I briefly mentioned last time is that I'll use omega to refer to the interacting vacuum, so the vacuum of an interacting theory. Too small. In general, if we perturb our Lagrangian or perturb our Hamiltonian, we'll change the spectrum of the theory, including the ground state. So if we add a perturbation, the ground state in general will change. So here, omega is referring to the ground state of our interacting theory. And this T refers to time ordering. It's a prescription for which order the field operators appear. It's the latest operators appear to the left. And we'll have more to say about that later. So this is the part of the story we're going to do today. But ultimately, we'd like to compute these complex numbers so we can find the amplitude for some initial state to evolve into some final state. So this is only part of the story. And the rest we'll do, we won't get to today, but we'll get to later this week. So the next step will be to relate this Heisenberg picture expression. It involves the interacting vacuum, the Heisenberg picture fields, to a interaction picture expression, where we can write things in terms of the essentially the free fields. So here, this is the free vacuum. And these are interaction picture fields. And to do that, we'll use Dyson's formula. As you discussed with Bindia earlier in the course. So this is an object that's simpler to compute than this Heisenberg picture expression, but again, not but something we can't in general compute exactly. So we'll use perturbation theory, as well as Wick's theorem. To relate this vacuum expectation value, the time-ordered product of M fields, to the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of two fields. And this is something you've actually computed with Bindia earlier in the course. And we'll approach this from a different perspective, but we'll see that we get the same result. So this last part of the story we'll approach in a different way. So that's where we're going. And later in the course, we're going to use a different technique that will allow us to essentially skip some of the steps here. Using a graphical technique first developed by Feynman, known as Feynman diagrams. So later, near the end of this week and next week, we'll see that we can skip some of the steps and directly relate this and this, or this and this with Feynman diagrams. So Feynman diagrams are a way to associate diagrams with each term in the perturbative expansion of either this expression or this expression. There's a dictionary that we'll learn that will allow us to write down mathematical expressions with each diagram. And those mathematical expressions will exactly match what we'll get when we approach this problem analytically. Okay. So that's where we're going over the next week and a bit more. Any questions? Comments? All right, so our more immediate goal is just to do this first step, to relate the scattering amplitude, which is expressed in terms of momentum eigenstates or ladder operators acting on the vacuum, with the vacuum expectation value, the time-ordered product of fields. And to derive the LSZ reduction formula, we're going to need to make a few assumptions. Some of these assumptions you may question, whether they make sense, whether they can be realized at all. The later part of the lecture, I will provide more justification for why these assumptions make sense and are reasonable and we can implement them. For now, I'm just going to list them and give you some motivation for why they're useful, but we'll justify them later. So our first assumption will be that there exist operators AK and AP dagger. In general, will be time dependent, that obey, at least at equal times, the commutation relations, the same commutation relations as in the free theory. So in particular, 2 pi cubed, 2 EP, delta P minus K. So I claim this is a definition. So if we have operators that obey these commutation relations, that means that AK annihilates a particle and AP creates a particle. So there should be some operators in our theory that do that, right? Add a particle or remove a particle. And I'm just giving them a name. A and A dagger. So this is our definition of our ladder operators in our interacting theory. They're not yet related in any way to our field operators. Now, our whole goal is to relate the ladder operators to the field operators. So we need to make some additional assumptions to be able to do that. And we'll do that in a minute. The first assumption I'm going to make, though, is that the vacuum state is Poincaré invariant. Means it's invariant under translations, boosts, rotations. That's sort of a physically reasonable expectation for a relativistic theory. Next assumption I'll make is that if you take the field operator and act on the vacuum state, we get a one particle state, at least at asymptotic times. And this third assumption, or the third bullet point, combined with the definition of above, already tells us something about how the field operator is related to the ladder operators at asymptotic times. We know that this basically tells us that phi should be linear in A dagger at asymptotic times. If we had a term that was quadratic in A dagger, then there'd be a two particle part of the state at asymptotic times. Or if there was a term that had no operators at all, a constant, again, that would mean there's a zero particle contribution to the state at asymptotic times. Okay, so this assumption is certainly questionable. Doesn't seem at all obvious from what I've said so far that we can do this. After all, if we have an interacting theory, particle number is not conserved. Like particle creation and annihilation, it's one of the key features of quantum field theory that we expect. So it's not clear that we can do this. So this assumption basically tells us that we can write phi of x as an integral d3k for 2 pi cubed 2ek. We should have a term here that's like ak dagger. It doesn't tell us anything about the coefficient. So we had the coefficient here just being an exponential in the free theory. That would be great if we could have the same exponential here. And that's where our next assumption comes in. We will assume that k phi of x omega, this is known as the form factor. Is e to the I k dot x. This fixes the coefficient. And this tells us then that we have the same e to the I k dot x here. And if we make the further assumption, which we'll do for now, and we'll relax that in the tutorial later, that phi is real, then we also know that we have here ak of t e to the minus I k dot x. So this is if phi is real. So with these assumptions, we have the same relation between our field operator and our ladder operators as we did in the free theory, with one change. So we're in the Heisenberg picture here. In the free theory, there'd be no time dependence for these ladder operators. With our assumptions, working in the Heisenberg picture, there's this extra time dependence, extra unknown time dependence for these ladder operators. We know that, by definition, these operators satisfy this commutation relation at equal times. We don't know how they evolve in time. Okay. We need one additional mild assumption so that we can invert this relation. We assume that the boundary condition terms vanish. In particular, we need ak dagger of plus or minus infinity to be the derivative of this to be zero. Then we can invert this relation. There's a quiz question on that. I know many of you have yet to do that, but I do encourage you to do the quizzes. You'll find we'll use a number of the results in the lectures and tutorials. Some of them also make good interview follow-up questions too. So I do encourage you to take a look at those quizzes. And as you showed, or will show, on one of the quizzes, this relation can be inverted. So we can solve for a and a dagger as functions of the field operator. And the expression is, at least at asymptotic times, because this is minus I spatial integral of
So does A annihilate the interacting vacuum at infinite time? Or?
Yes. Yes, it does. So we're assuming that this is the ground state, which we can in fact make a stronger statement. It's actually A annihilates the vacuum at any time.
But can't I then use the commutation relation to start building up my Hilbert space, and I have a concern that the Hilbert space will then be the same as in the free theory, because I can just take creation operators, put it on some vacuum, and
so at any fixed time, you can do that. What is new in the interacting theory is the time evolution. Yeah, so we're. And in particular, note we don't yet have any explicit map between these operators and our operators in the free theory. So there doesn't have to be a connection, direct connection.
But will I get a ladder of states at each time?
Yes.
But isn't that a free field theory thing that I can just start adding states like this in a ladder?
So I haven't said anything about the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian. So the energy of those states is not necessarily just the sum of the energies of the individual particles. I also haven't said anything about made any concrete statements about how the time evolution works. So we don't know that a two particle state will evolve to be a two particle state. In general, it won't. So that. I basically just assume that we can talk about particles. There's a meaningful sense in which we can talk about particle number at a fixed time. Thanks for the question. Yes, Marco.
This last assumption that we made seems pretty arbitrary. Can you repeat why we fixed that coefficient like that?
That tells us that the coefficient here is the same as in the free theory. So that will let us use our results from the free theory, which is something that will be extremely convenient for us later on. Mm-hmm. This in a sense, is a choice of normalization.
Okay.
Here we're saying something about the number of particles. So there's more physics in this first statement than the second one.
These assumptions imply in the when the time is positive infinity and negative infinity, the particles are only interacting.
That's right. We're essentially assuming that in the far past and far future, we're free theory. Okay. For concreteness, let's assume that our initial and final state have exactly two particles. So we'll assume that in the Heisenberg picture, our initial state is A dagger K1. All right, let me introduce shorthand notation. I'll call this A dagger 1, A dagger 2 at 0. in the vacuum state, where a dagger I is defined to be a dagger ki. So I'm going to write the k's all the time. And our final state, again in the Heisenberg picture, is d3 dagger, d4 dagger, 0. So we're in the Heisenberg picture, so our states are time independent. In the Heisenberg picture, we have this explicit time evolution operator that evolves, indicates here the time evolution. So with that assumption, we can write scattering amplitude we're interested in as A4 at plus infinity, A3 plus infinity, A1 dagger minus infinity, A2 dagger minus infinity. The time evolution operator will push the initial state operators back to the asymptotic past, and the final state operators to the asymptotic future. So the S here changed the arguments. So this is the amplitude we want to compute. And the way we're going to do it is by making two observations. So one, we can note that this expression is already time ordered. So I haven't changed anything by inserting this time ordering symbol here. And time ordering means if we have some operators that are evaluated at some times, t1 and t2. So this means we put the later operator to the left. So this is equal to O of T1, O of T2. If T1 is greater than T2, and O of T2, O of T1, otherwise. So this is the latest to the left. The other thing we need to do to derive the LSZ reduction formula is to relate the ladder operators to field operators. And well, we have an expression on the top board up there that does that. But a more useful way to do this is using the useful identity. That relates the ladder operators at plus infinity to ladder operators at minus infinity. Let me just make sure I get the signs right. So here the identity is a dagger 1 of plus infinity minus a 1 dagger minus infinity. And this is equal minus I. Plus or minus, minus. Okay. Got all the signs right. Minus, minus. Yes. So this is our useful identity. The reason this is useful, when we plug this in here, we'll relate the A daggers at minus infinity to a daggers at plus infinity, and then time ordering will push it over to the left. And so that, once we use this identity to change this a1 minus infinity to a1 plus infinity, the only thing that will be left is this integral. And we'll do that explicitly in a minute. These are the key two ideas we're going to use to derive this. One is this identity, and the other is the fact that we're already time ordered. So a few comments about this identity. Let's give the right hand side a name. Let's call this I1 dagger. We have here the Klein-Gordon operator acting on the field. In a free theory, this would give us what? What do we get if we act with the Klein-Gordon operator on the field? Zero. Right. So this is zero in the Klein-Gordon theory, in a free theory. But note, so far, we've made no assumptions about what theory we're considering. The only assumption we've made is that it's a theory of a real scalar field that is Lorentz invariant. We haven't specified a Lagrangian. We haven't specified a Hamiltonian. Haven't made any assumptions about what the interactions are. So this would apply to the Klein-Gordon theory, in which case we'd get a very simple answer. But it also applies to other theories. And in general, if we change the Lagrangian to of the Klein-Gordon theory by adding an extra term, we'd have extra terms in the equation of motion, and this would not be zero anymore. Okay. So let's prove this identity. Okay, so the first step, we can note that we can write the difference of these operators using the fundamental theorem of calculus. Write this as an integral, minus infinity to infinity, dt of the derivative of a1 dagger. I think I switched back and forth between d0 and dt. Those mean the same thing. Okay. So the next thing we can do is plug in the formula on the right-hand side of that board. We plug in this formula, which follows directly from our assumptions. We get a longer expression. Okay. We can then evaluate this time derivative. Try to see. So there are a number of terms. We get a term when the derivative acts on the exponential, another term when we act on the derivative of the field. I'm missing a parenthesis here. Yeah, so there are four terms. Two of them will cancel. So the two terms that survive, I'm not going to go through all the algebra, There's a key point coming up that I do want to emphasize. So the other terms cancel. We are left with two terms, which are d0 squared and plus ek1 squared acting on 5 of x. So the other terms, the terms with one derivative will cancel, as you can check. So we have a minus sign. If we take the derivative with respect to this times that term, or we'd get a plus sign if we take the time derivative of this term. And now we're coming up on the key point. One more step, and then we'll get to the key point. This is a continuation from before. We can write Ek as k squared plus m squared. And this is a physical relation, the relativistic dispersion relation. E squared, the energy we measure, is related to the momentum we measure and the mass we measure. So these are all things we can measure. In particular, the mass can be measured. I'm just using the relativistic dispersion relation. I have not written down a Lagrangian or Hamiltonian. If you ask what's the mass that appears in the Lagrangian, well, I don't know at this point that that's the same as the mass that shows up here. I made no assumptions about the form of the Lagrangian. Okay, so this is the key point here. To derive this relation, I need to use this physical relativistic dispersion relation. E squared is k squared plus m squared. From here, we can integrate by parts to write this k squared in terms of the derivative. The rest is essentially math, but this step is where the physics is. That's a k1. All right, so d squared minus grad squared. Integration by parts. And then if we combine the derivatives, we have the promised expression. Questions about that? Yes, yeah.
Like in the second step, you will just insert the formula on the very top into the expression of A1 diagonal. But that formula is the as T2 positive negative infinity, but how can you find it?
Sorry. Yeah, yes. So I This should work at all times. This follows from the above equation. You do need to make assumptions about how the operators behave at infinity. Thank you. That was a bit, yeah. Right there. Okay. So, yes.
Oh. In the same equation, should the e to the minus ikx be also multiplied to the ek?
Yes, it should. Parentheses missing. Thanks, Yeo-jung. Yes, sir.
So if I take the relativistic dispersion relation, won't I then have ladders in energy from that first assumption?
Each extra particle will be associated with some extra energy, according to that relativistic dispersion relation. But we're not assuming anything about interaction energies. There could be additional sources of energies, be particles that interact. It's not true. Not necessarily true that the energy of two particles is just the energy of two free particles. There could be an interaction term. The energy could be greater than that or less than that.
But doesn't the commutator kind of imply that? Like, if I take the relativistic dispersion relation and just the commutation relation, shouldn't I get like some
sort of... to ask what the energy of a state is here, we'd need a Hamiltonian. We don't have that. This does imply that the energy of a one particle state is k squared plus m squared. Okay, so if we combine our ideas, this time ordering and this useful identity, what we get is that FSI is omega. Here we're using the useful identity. Time ordering of, there's a bunch of terms. So it'll be one term where we have a 4 of minus infinity, a 3 of minus infinity, a 1 dagger of plus infinity, a 2 dagger of plus infinity. That's going to be 2 to the 4 terms. This is one of them. And we can say something about this term right away. What do we know about this term? Huh?
Lattices.
That's right. Why?
Because of the time ordering, the NLS operators will act on the vacuum state.
Exactly. Yes, so time ordering means that we put the latest operators to the left. So these A daggers go annihilate the bra vacuum, and the A's go and annihilate the cat vacuum. And in fact, that will be true for all of the other terms, except for the term that only involves the I's or I daggers, the integrals. Any of the 16 terms that have one or more ladder operator will vanish. So here what we're doing is we're using this equation to replace the A daggers at minus infinity with A daggers at plus infinity plus an integral, and same for the A's. So 15 of the 16 terms will have either an A dagger at plus infinity or an A at minus infinity. So those will vanish. The only term that's left will be the term that is I4, I3, I1 dagger, I2 dagger. And so that gives us the LSZ reduction from this. So our final result is that FSI is an integral. So we have four integrals here. Let me write this as product from I equals 1 to 4. We also have four exponentials. The signs in the exponentials will depend on if it comes from an I dagger or not. So this lambda here will be plus or minus 1, depending on where it came from. We then also have Klein-Gordon operators. And finally, a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields. That's what was promised at the beginning of the lecture. So just to be clear on my notation, I've introduced a few new things here. So here, phi I is defined to be phi of xi. This derivative here, d squared I means d xi mu d d x I nu eta mu nu. And here lambda I is equal to, let's make sure I got my signs consistent. Yes. Plus 1 for initial particles and minus 1 for final particles. And so this is our key result for today. So this lets us compute the scattering amplitudes, which are formulated in terms of ladder operators, by computing a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields. And this expression is easier to do because the natural way to at least the way in this course that we're formulating our theories, is in terms of a Lagrangian, which is expressed in terms of fields.
For how did a lambda appear in the last equation?
Yes. So in our useful formula, we have that the A daggers are related to this integral, the difference in the creation operator at plus and minus infinity is this integral. We can also take the Hermitian conjugate of this equation, which will turn the A daggers into A's. It will also flip the sign here and the sign here. So I is almost the same expression, just with two minus signs. Okay. All right, this is a good place to break. Unless you had a question, Tom?
Yeah, I wanted to ask if the parenthesis of the product from 1 to 4 should go before the
Oh, yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. That was here. So there's one Klein-Gordon operator for each field.
Oh, and also, I can see where you defined partial squared of phi. Shouldn't the contraction be with the inverse?
You're right. It should be upstairs. Thank you. Okay, let's break. We'll resume in 5 minutes at 11:40. everything big enough?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So then,
yeah.
I didn't get sort of how the so I'm looking at the scattering, the S matrix thing. So you haven't actually said anything about what it is, except that it evolves initial states to final states. So I don't get how it turns the Schrödinger operators into like the infinity.
Yes. So I'm assuming that it has the following property. So S
is like a
keeping notation is the time of which an operator becomes one.
But is that in the that's in the Heisenberg picture?
That's right. So if you want to relate the Heisenberg picture operator, the operator in the Heisenberg picture. Expression. I basically took this and inserted an S dagger S here and looked at
it. Oh, I see. Yeah. Makes sense.
For the phis in the final equation, they are interacting fields, not Klein-Gordon fields. Is that right?
These are Heisenberg picture fields. This works for the Klein-Gordon field, but we have not assumed anything about the refraction. So this could be a Klein-Gordon field, or it could be a different scalar field.
But
it's still a scalar field, but by a different scalar field, I mean one of the different refractions.
Should we also assume that the interacting vacuum is annihilated by the A's? Because I don't see how it flows from like Planck
area.
Yeah, so
we also
need to
assume that. Yeah, I could do that. It essentially follows from the fact that if you take the definition, the vacuum would be the lowest energy state. If we get a projection, if it's the lowest energy state, we'll be
What if I don't have an energy operator in my QFT?
No.
You
don't have an energy operator.
Yes, so like, because this seems very general, so I think it should hold even when I don't have a Hamiltonian. It's just like this kind of formula.
Good question. Let me think about it. We can discuss after.
Okay. So this is our key result. Key result for today. It says that we can compute scattering amplitude by Fourier transforming and acting with Klein-Gordon operators on a vacuum expectation value, a time order product of fields. So we're going to use this repeatedly in this course and future courses whenever we want to compute a scattering amplitude. What I'd like to discuss in the second part of class today, though, is why does this work? Why are those assumptions reasonable? Why are they self-consistent? What do we need to do to our theories in order to make these assumptions work? So the assumptions we want to check are the ones related to the field operator. Commutation relation was a definition of the latter operators. We're just going to assume it's a reasonable physical assumption that our vacuum is Poincaré invariant. So I won't have more to say about that. But the assumptions you might want to question are that are there phi acting on the vacuum, it's a one particle state. For t equals plus or minus infinity. And this means a few things. So in particular, this means that it has no zero particle contribution. There's no zero particle component to that state. So that tells us that if we project, take this state and project onto the vacuum, we should get zero. It also means that the overlap of this state with a multi-particle state should be zero. So these are assumptions we want to check. And the other assumption we made was about the form factor. So we also assumed that the form factor, which is k phi omega, was e to the I k dot x. And this one tells us about the overlap of this one particle state, phi omega, with another one particle state. So we'll approach them in that order. So the first, we'll do these. First, this is about zero particle states. This is about one particle states. And this is about its overlap with multi-particle states. So those are the things we need to check. OK. So our first one, we want to look at this expression. Now, we're assuming our theory has Lorentz invariants. And so we can relate phi of x to phi of 0. Using generalization of the relationship between the Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture. Instead of just using time translation operators, the Hamiltonian, we can use space-time translation operators, the four moment. So we can write this as e to the I p dot x e to the I. And which one has the minus sign? Someone? This way? Yeah. All right, so this is the way we can relate phi of x to phi of 0. So this is a So the forward momentum, which generates space-time translation. These operators are something to look at in more detail in QFT1 with Gong. Gong will have a lot more to say about Lorentz transformations and Poincaré symmetry. But for now, we'll just assume that this works. Basically, as you expect, this is just a natural generalization of the Heisenberg-Schrodinger relation, in some sense. So if we plug this into our expression for the vacuum expectation value of the field, we see that we can write this as like this. By assumption, our vacuum is Poincaré invariant, so we can simplify this expression. If we for translate our vacuum, we just get back the vacuum state, and that's exactly what these operators are doing. So we can say, on general principles, that this vacuum expectation value, which a priori depended on space-time, is just a constant. That's all. There's nothing more we can say about this on general grounds. So at first glance, this seems to doom our whole derivation. Unfortunately, there's something rather straightforward that we can do if, for the theory we're studying, this vacuum expectation value turns out to be non-zero. We can fix this problem by shifting the field. Let's call this vacuum expectation value V. If we define a new field called phi tilde of x, and it's equal to our original field minus V, then the vacuum expectation value of phi tilde, by construction, is zero. So we can make this assumption work as long as we're willing to shift our field. So this works with a shift.
So does this mean that in order to use and everything that we have derived after the assumptions, we have to check that the log of phi is equal to zero?
That's right. That's the way I presented it. Alternatively, you could go through and rederive it with changing our assumptions. You'd end up with a huge mess, but could generalize our assumptions. Okay. So that our first assumption passes our check with this shift. The next thing we want to check is whether the form factor, this k phi omega is referred to as the form factor, is equal to this exponential or can be made equal to this exponential. Okay. Okay. So we're going to try the same thing as we did before. We'll rewrite phi of x as phi of 0 with the four translation operators. And again, the vacuum Poincaré invariance. So translated vacuum is the same as the untranslated vacuum. But over here, we have a momentum eigenstate. So this state is an eigenvalue of p hat. So we can write this as e to the I k dot x times k. And we get an expression like this. So we have the factor we want, this exponential, and something extra. We'd like this to be 1. Now, there's nothing else we can say on general grounds about what this amplitude is. But we can use the fact. And I won't justify this in detail now. It's something you'll discuss in a lot more detail with Gong about how the amplitudes transform under Lorentz and Poincaré transformations. But the claim I'll make is that this is Lorentz invariant. And it's Lorentz invariant, and it depends. Well, the only parameter it can depend on is k. And so we want to this has to be a Lorentz invariant function of k. The only thing we can construct from k alone is k squared. Which is m squared, which is just a number. So again, we can't say anything about the value of this, but we can say that this is a constant, and it's independent of spacetime. Now, again, that seems to be a problem. It doesn't work with our assumptions if this is not 1. But it's an easy problem to fix, just like we fixed the problem with the vacuum excitation value of the field before by shifting. We can solve this problem by rescaling. We call phi tilde of x to be equal to let's call this z. If we rescale, then we will have that the rescaled field will have the correct form factor. And I should have mentioned this explicitly before, but we'll assume we do this. We'll assume we shift and rescale, and we'll drop the tildes from now on. We'll just assume that we've done the shifting and rescaling whenever we use the LZ reduction formula from now on. So also drop the tildes. So that. So this we can do the second one with the rescaling. Questions on the first part? Okay, so the final check we need to do is ask whether we can distinguish single versus multi-particle states asymptotically. So here, we need to introduce some new notation. Let's call a multiparticle state P sigma. And the total three momentum of the state will play a special role, so we're going to specify pulling out that parameter. This is the total three momentum. And sigma is all other parameters. So this will include discrete parameters like particle number, also include continuous parameters like relative momenta, might also, depending on the system, include other parameters like charge or particle type. Those other parameters won't play much of a role in what I have to say, but the total three momentum will, so I'm specifying that out. But in general, there could be many, many other parameters here that I'm just collectively grouping as sigma. And they could be continuous or discrete. Okay. So the first step in seeing whether we can make this assumption work is formulating mathematically what do we mean by distinguishing single particle and multi-particle states. We need to impose mathematically the right condition. The simplest thing we could try is asking whether P sigma phi of x omega, at least in the asymptotic past or future, be zero. So this would say that our one particle state has no overlap with any multi-particle state in the asymptotic past or future. That's too strong a condition. We're interested in the case where we have an unstable particle that decays. If we impose this, that would not be possible. This is too strong. We want to be able to describe particle decay. We can try something else. We could ask about whether this amplitude could and demand that this amplitude was zero. But this has the same problem. We want to be able to describe the decay of a particle, so this again is too strong. The correct condition we should impose is that the amplitude for a one particle wave packet to evolve into a, write the limit explicitly. This is a one particle wave packet. To evolve into a multi-particle wave packet. Goes to zero. So this would still allow for the decay of particles. What this is saying is that there's a meaningful sense in which we can talk about how many particles there are at asymptotic times. It turns out that with a mild additional assumption about the spectrum, this condition is automatically satisfied. More details are in the notes for those of you who are interested, and I'm happy to discuss further, but I'm not going to go through all the details. I just want to sketch the key point and emphasize the one additional mild assumption we need to make. So you can compute this, and what you find is that it's an integral over momentum of a complicated expression, the details of which won't matter for us. But it does have a factor of e to the I p0 minus k10 t. So here, p0 is the energy of the multiparticle state. And we can write this as the 3 vector p squared plus m squared to the half, where big M is the invariant mass of the multiparticle state. K10 in that expression is again p squared. We're assuming we have a Lorentz invariant theory where Poincaré invariant where momentum is conserved. So the moment for this amplitude to be potentially non-zero, the initial and final momentum have to be the same. So this will involve p squared plus m squared, where this little m is the mass of the particle. And this integral vanishes as long as p minus k is not zero. There's a theorem, the Riemann-Lebesgue theorem, that says that integrals of this type are guaranteed to vanish in the limit t goes to infinity or minus infinity, as long as we have a non-zero coefficient here. And that's for a theory with weak coupling, that's guaranteed. For a free theory, we have that m is greater than 2m, which is greater than m. So the coefficient and the exponent is non-zero. For an interacting theory, the mass of a two-particle, or so the energy of a the invariant thinking about this as the center of mass energy. The center of mass energy of a two-particle state might not be strictly greater than twice the mass of a two-particle state if there's some binding energy. But as long as that binding energy isn't enough to push this mass below the mass of a single particle, then there's a meaningful sense in which we can distinguish one particle states and two particle states. The spectrum will have a gap between the ground state, the one particle state, and the multi-particle states. And as long as that gap exists, then this overlap is zero. And what this is saying physically is that one and multi-particle states, multi-particle wave packets, spread out differently. As t goes to infinity, or minus infinity, and the overlap goes to zero. And that's physically reasonable. Again, more details are in the notes for those of you who are interested. Any questions on the ideas here? I realize I didn't go through that much of the math. Yes, Tom?
So what would be different in the derivation if m was equal to little m in an interactive theory?
Well, in that case, this would fail. In that case, this overlap would not be guaranteed to go to zero. We'd have an exponential of zero. So this oscillates if the coefficient here is real and non-zero, then this oscillates more and more rapidly as t goes to infinity, and those the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma guarantees that integrals of this form, those oscillations lead to cancellations of the integrand, so it goes to zero in that limit. This could be non-zero in that case, in which case there might not be a meaningful distinction between one particles and multi-particles in that system. If you had a very strongly coupled system, you might not be able to talk about particle number at all.
So the point where our proof breaks is that we get the initial or the final state, for that matter, have a specific number of particles because there's no distinction. Right?
That's right. Thanks for the question.
And another question. Mm-hmm. It's about the rescaling. Shouldn't it be with z to the minus 1?
Oh, yes, to match up with what we're going to do later, yes. Okay. For what I said here, it won't matter, but to match up with later. Okay. So let's suppose we're interested in applying what we've done here to a specific theory. For concreteness, I'll consider phi cube theory, which is the Klein-Gordon theory we have been studying, with an additional interaction term. Which has some coupling constant g times the field cubed. This is a coupling constant. which determines the strength of the self-interactions of the field, or the particles. So this is a theory we might be interested in, and we'll study this theory later in the course. But for now, let's just ask, what would we have to do if we want to study this theory, compute scattering amplitudes in this theory, using the LSZ reduction formula? Well, what we've seen is that if we want to make our assumptions work, we have to shift and rescale. So call this the naive Lagrangian. We won't be able to use LSZ reduction formula if we take the Lagrangian to be this form. In general, what we have to do is shift and rescale. And if we do that, what do we get? We get, and I'm also going to rename some of the constants. Make sure I'm matching with the notes. Yes. Okay. So if we the rescaling will change the coefficient of the kinetic term. This is a term with derivatives, kinetic and gradient terms, to be something different from a half. So I'm going to call that extra coefficient z phi. It changes the coefficient of the quadratic term to be something different from m squared. It, in general, changes the coefficient of the interaction term to be something different from g over 3 factorial. And the shifting will also generate new terms. So if we shift a cubic function, we'll get a quadratic, also a linear term, and a constant term. We'll drop the constant term. That won't affect the dynamics. But this linear term will be generated from the shift. And so we see that we have these extra factors, z phi, zm, zg, and y, that show up. And our conditions on the form factor and the vacuum expectation value will put constraints on these coefficients. So we're not allowed to just choose any Lagrangian we want. We need to do the shifting and rescaling. This is part of the process of renormalization. So renormalization is required. Our conditions put constraints. On the zi's and y. And this is something we'll explore more next week. For the remainder of this week, we're just going to temporarily forget about this issue. This week, we'll assume that the zi's are all equal to 1. So any change in the coefficients don't occur. and we won't get any new terms. For, and this is consistent to do, as we'll see, at leading order in perturbation theory. But fails generally beyond leading order. And the reason we're going to make this inconsistent assumption beyond leading order is really just to so we can develop the machinery of perturbation theory before we apply it consistently. To an interesting interacting theory like this one or others we'll see later in the course. Questions? Yes, Bob.
So here to me it seems that this randomization is kind of a consequence of having like a nice mathematical formula for like scattering, but mm-hmm. if I didn't do this randomization, could I still like? I would have to like change my formula for the S matrix, but the Lagrangian would be simpler or something like that.
Yes. There's ways you can push these factors around. You could make these factors show up in the LZ reduction formula instead of in your Lagrangian. That's something you can do. This statement is still true regardless of how you redefine things. We still need to make. Explicit assumptions relating the parameters in our Lagrangian to the parameters we can measure. And that implies we have to renormalize our theory.
Why is it called renormalization? When have we normalized it before?
It's a terrible name.
Okay.
We never normalized things in a reasonable way before. This name is historical. But you can, normalization would be a better name. Other questions? Careful.
Normally how renormalization is seen is that there are UB and IR divergences in the theory, so we
yes.
need to bypass them in some way. I don't see where we got this picture. I mean, we did not we did not talk about divergences that were brought, in the picture.
Yes, so the presence of divergences is a sufficient reason that we have to renormalize, but it's not necessary. That we'll see examples later in this course where we have finite theories. Nevertheless, there's interesting renormalization. Okay. So I haven't explained how to do this or what the physics says. This is something we'll explore next week and also in future courses. There's a lot to say about renormalization. This is just our very first introduction. There's a lot.
So you were saying something like I can relate these z's to quantities that I can like measure, but I'm not sure if I can measure. Can I measure the form factor or something like that? Or, like the k, the phi, and can I measure that somehow?
That would depend on which renormalizations you imposed. So asking about what you can measure independent of the renormalization conditions is not a well-defined question. You need to ask what we can measure. If I just write down this theory and don't give you any renormalization conditions, I can't make a concrete connection between the theory and what I can measure. I need to have a relation that tells me what do I mean by the mass? What do I mean by the coupling constant? How am I relating what I'm computing with this theory to what I'm measuring?
You mentioned that the constant G accounts for self-interaction. So I was wondering, how we know if self-interaction?
Okay, so this term is a modification of the Lagrangian. It also leads to a modification of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian would have a phi cubed term. It's saying there's some energy associated with the cube of the field at a particular point that will lead to an interaction between three, because the fields are related to the particles. The particles are the elementary excitation of the fields. That this will also lead to there being an interaction term or a term in the Hamiltonian that describes how one particle can evolve into two particles or three particles can meet at a point in space-time, more generally. We'll go into that in more detail tomorrow and later in the week. But conceptually, we're modifying the Hamiltonian. Okay. Thank you for all the questions. Again, if you prefer to ask anonymous questions or have feedback, there are feedback forms at the end of each row. I appreciate any feedback you have there. Otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow.